So we come, as the title slide suggests, to what is now our 15th class in a discussion of miracles. It's by far the most comprehensive study that I've done in my life's time. It may be for each of you as well that to spend 15 lessons, we've got several more to go, you know, on the nature of miracles is pretty unusual, I believe. But as long as it has been, I hope that it has proven fruitful. Try to be careful to find unique or particularly important aspects of miracles, both Old and New Testament, for each and every class. But the number of miracles that have been performed, not so much in the Old Testament, which are really quite limited, but in the New, which eclipses the Old Testament number many times over, the actual number we cannot know. What we've already discovered, though, is that we've seen time and time again already, and it will continue to be the case, that we'll be reading in the life of Jesus about his miracles in particular, that there were many others that he did that aren't recorded. Just the notation, multitudes are healed over here, multitudes are healed over there, multitudes are healed in the north, multitudes are healed in the south. Everyone who comes to him is healed. And so beyond all conceivable doubt, with 50 that are discussed, that are referenced, that you have information about, where a story is told just in the Gospels, and then these numerous references to many others, it's apparent to me, brethren, that there must have been something on the order of 1,000 miracles. 500 seems entirely too small when you go multitudes and multitudes and multitudes. And so try to just comprehend that for a moment as we begin the class this morning. Jesus himself went into every corner of a tiny little land of Israel. Actually, about 150 miles from north to south is all, you know, the area that he traversed, and perhaps as much as 50 miles from the Mediterranean Sea to the furthest east in that region, in a very, very small area. Jesus has worked perhaps 1,000 miracles in 3.5 years. We're about halfway through that study right now. And as we're looking at these miracles, then, they are of every kind for everybody under any circumstances. There's no exception. The healing will take place as Jesus sets about performing that miracle. And it's not just that we have 1,000 miracles. Do we have a miracle over behind closed doors that only the guy that gets healed knows about? Miracle number two, a guy over here that nobody else knows about. Miracle number three, out in the boat on the lake with one guy, nobody else sees it. Are there miracles like that? No. Whether or not you are the person who is walking on water, being raised from the dead, healed of any sickness, demon is cast out, or as we'll see twice today, watching the Lord perform the miracle of feeding thousands when he has as little as a young boy's lunch to work with. If you are witnessing those things, the number of people that would have seen these miracles taking place is numbering likely in the tens of thousands then. So what we are talking about is enormous numbers of eyewitnesses who have either experienced the healings themselves. I'm using healings because that's the thing that happens the most, but every range of miracle, you know, but they've seen it happen. They've seen it happen in crowds. People are standing 360 degrees around every conceivable viewpoint. They're crowding up against him just to touch him. You can be healed. See that again for a second time today. And so it is the most well-attested fact, I suppose, in human history, is that Jesus came and performed miracles and demonstrated a power over all of physical creation, all of the weaknesses and problems of the human flesh, and even over the spirit world in the casting out of the demons. And of course, we will find Romans itself will declare it to be the greatest of all the miracles, that he will be raised from the dead ultimately. So, if you were there, was there any doubt in your mind? No. Nobody doubted it then. even those who hated him still admitted the miracles. They just attributed them to whom? Beelzebub, to Satan, you know, Lord of the Flies. It is just amazing that for that time frame, there's no dissenting voice. Today, of course, we have lots of people who claim things never happened, that they weren't there. Had they been there like everybody else, they would have attested to the fact. But we're starting to see an awful lot of overlap now, too, in thousands of these events. So we're going to try to go through more than we have so far. And again, just trying to highlight things that are unique. We'll be able to pick up the pace here. And then in a matter of another few weeks, we'll be done with the miracles themselves. We'll enter in then to our study of what the Bible says about how long they were to last. As always, trying to group them to make it as easy as possible for you. I'm going to be sticking mostly in Matthew this morning, but first, we need to lead off with Mark. I didn't get to finish up 2 weeks ago as I would have liked, and so I want to spend a little bit of time with Mark chapter 6. This is one that has been used traditionally to great effect in the last 100 years by those who are faking miracles. This is their chief excuse for their failures, which are not just legion, but which are universally the case. They fail every time. They're just better at faking success on some occasions than they are on others. But in Mark chapter 6, their excuse when they fail, because they admit that they fail all the time, in Mark chapter 6 at verse 1, he went out from there and came into his hometown, and his disciples followed him. We're all familiar with the fact that Jesus will adopt as a hometown the city of Capernaum. But in this case, we're talking about the original place where he grew up, which is Nazareth. This happens to be Nazareth. And one of the more enjoyable things that you'll likely see when you go to Israel, this entire property, you can see this street right through here, but everything you see here, and then a great deal more on a hillside, is called Nazareth Village. It's an outstanding attempt to replicate what first century living was like. So you go through some displays, you know, down this building, then they have recreated a synagogue and a rolling stone tomb and these sorts of things. But this is Nazareth. Jesus grew up in this immediate vicinity. You'll notice that in Nazareth, they tried to kill Jesus on one occasion, and we have a precipice over here that he might have been thrown from. We have another precipice, even steeper over here, that he might have been thrown from. And so you can see how you've got a nice little bowl here up on the hills in a magnificent view of the Jezreel Valley. It would have been a wonderful place for a boy to grow up and for a young man to be working with his father. But it wasn't, you know, a big place. He was in an obscured area at the time, just kind of a village. And in verse 2, Jesus now, having come back as one who can work these miracles, when the Sabbath had come, began to teach in the synagogue. Many listeners were astonished, saying, "Where did this man get these things? What is this wisdom given to him? And such miracles as these performed by his hands." Please note that they're mentioning three things. Where did this man get these things? They want to know the source of things. The things, I think, are then listed, two of them. What is the wisdom given to him, and such miracles as these performed by his hands? Please never forget, brethren, that miracles are astonishing. Miracles are signs. But what do miracles do? They point at something else. They point at the fact that the individual is a representative of God, that the message comes from God. Do you note here in this particular passage, though, these people, you know, recognize in the message itself that it is a wisdom that they've never heard before. This just transcends any wisdom that they've seen before. And you don't need a miracle for that. We've already seen Jesus say, "Believe me because of the things I say, and if not, then believe me because of the works that I do, the miracles that I perform." But, you know, you don't have to see a miracle to recognize that what he said is above anything else that you've ever heard. And so he's got everybody's full attention because of the message itself, and then because of the verifying power of the miracles with regard to that message. So where's this come from? Well, it comes from God. We've never seen it. But these people grew up with Jesus. So a problem develops in this one town that is, you know, far greater than any place else or that Jesus has to face. In verse 3, is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? Of course, in that phrasing, it suggests that Joseph has already passed away. Are not his sisters here with us? It's just all these that are still living, but Joseph not mentioned. And they took offense at it. We know you. You're one of us. How can you be so much better than us? Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his own relatives and in his own household. Excuse me. This roughs up the voice. You don't have to do the talking. So, this statement, of course, is one of the more renowned of Jesus, more memorable of Jesus. Most of us may have experienced it as well. To use the secular form, familiarity breeds contempt. We've all heard that one too. And that's just the nature of the world. So it's a tough audience. This is the audience that knew him as a child. Where could he then get all these things? Are they denying that he did miracles? Never forget this, brethren, when you're looking at verse 2. Where did this man get these things, this wisdom, and such miracles as are performed? Are the people asking these questions, apparently significant numbers of them, are they denying that miracles have taken place? No, they're just offended at what he's doing. So they've got other, commitments, and they've got familiarity breeding that contempt, but they're not denying that he was working miracles. Then it says, and here's the modern Pentecostal's excuse, in verse 5, he could do no miracle there except that he laid his hands upon a few sick people and healed them. Did he do miracles there? It says he did miracles there. So he did do miracles there. He only did a few there. But what throws people off is this expression, he could do no miracle there. What's it mean he could do no miracle there? Brethren, I can do nothing that is contrary to my will. I could do nothing that I don't want to do. I don't want to do foolish and counterproductive things. You don't either. We're all the same. So is Jesus. When I say I could not do this or I could not do that, it's not a statement about my inability to do it if I wanted to. It's my choosing not to do it because it isn't going to accomplish the intended effect. So when it says this, not that he failed, not like he tried and flopped, because he chose not to. I'm sorry about this. I probably should have been talking more in the last few days. Trying to keep my voice up since this got started. Okay. Who's got the cough drop? Okay. I have never stood before any audience that did not up and beat me.
Or I couldn't find any cough drop. I told you this story before, and I got to meet you, Carl.
I nearly choked on one of these ones. So, anybody here know the Heimlich maneuver? Probably Mark back there. If I start gasping, it's not because I could not talk. It's because I'm choosing not to while I choke. Okay. I'm getting better turning off the mic when these things happen. Which is probably confusing everybody listening to the tape later now that I think about it. Okay. So, here in this place, Jesus comes. where everybody recognizes that he's working miracles, where everybody recognizes that his wisdom is absolutely superior. And then it says he could do no miracles. Why could he do no miracles there? And then it says that he did do miracles while he was there. What this says is it having the desired effect? Let me ask you this. If you have pearls and you're looking at swine, then what should you do? Keep them to yourself. This is all that Jesus is doing. So in verse 6, he wondered at their unbelief. That's true. He wondered at their unbelief. However, in the modern Pentecostal meeting, why is everybody there? Because they do believe. Never side see that. So the modern Pentecostal comes along, his attempt at a miracle fails, thus demonstrates he has not the power of Jesus or the apostles, and that his doctrine therefore is utterly false, his practice is a fake. You know, he gets exposed. Who does he blame his failure on? He says, you didn't have enough faith. Well, then why are they there? You know, of course they're there, because they have this hope. So don't let anybody, you know, give you a hard time with Mark chapter 6. Just help them to understand, depending on the circumstances, some, you know, are corrupt, of course, and particularly in Pentecostalism, there's a tremendous amount of hypocrisy and fakery. They've been busted, you know, so many times, it's just ridiculous, and all kinds of documentaries written on how they do it. But it's all, you know, it's all fake in one sense or another. Don't let them blame it on their victim. Their victim is the poor person who came because they do believe in them and find out that that faith is misplaced. Here, these people, they accept the miracles, but they will not accept that he is what? Son of God. Because they know him to be son of Joseph and Mary, and he's got brothers and sisters, and they're all right here in the town with us. He can't be the son of God. Miracles say otherwise. They got the family relationship, so Jesus is without honor. Okay, I'm going to move to the next one here, which starts in verse 7. He summoned the 12, began to send them out in pairs. He was giving them authority over unclean spirits, and you can see, skip down to 13 and 14. They were casting out demons and anointing with oil many sick people and healing them. This is like the fourth time we got these minis. And Herod heard of it, for his name had become well known. People were saying, John the Baptist has risen from the dead. That's why these miraculous powers are at work at him. Well, Herod heard, and people were saying, that's why these what are at work in him? These miraculous powers. So once again, everybody is believing. Now, on that photograph over here, I didn't take this particular one, but this is a location on the Nazareth ridgeline. So this is very close to Nazareth itself. This one, you see the Jezreel Valley. And so Jesus now has got 12 disciples, the apostles. He's sending them out. They're working miracles. The other Gospels explain more about this and the results of this. But I'm just saying it takes miraculous power to bestow miraculous power. So it is a miracle in itself that Jesus can give them the power to do this. What cities they went to, we don't know. At the time, the entire Galilean region was really thickly populated. It was heavily populated at that time. Likely more populated even than it is today. And you can see these little villages here, there, and everywhere. These little villages, you know, down in the valley and everywhere else. Mount Tabor, by the way, is where Deborah and Barak got together, and then we've got Nain on the side of the hill of Moriah here where the young man is raised from the dead, and far side you've got Mounts of Gilboa and Ahab's palaces over there, Gideon's 300, and how they drank the water determined whether they'd go to war or not. Jezreel Valley has an enormous amount of biblical history in it. So I've always loved this picture. I've found it before. You've probably seen it before. But perhaps these are some of the little villages that they might have gone to. Many of these locations have had people living in them, you know, for centuries. So it's just a statement, though, that Jesus sent them out to do these things. And so now you've got 12 men working miracles, and they're working many miracles. In the first century, there wasn't any question about it. You know, those who don't believe it today can join the unbelievers in the city of Nazareth who will not accept what is right before their eyes. You have to marvel at that. Now let's come over to Matthew and chapter 14. We're going to be looking at verses 15 through 21. Matthew 14, 15 through 21. Now, I'll tell you in advance, I've collected this data that I put up on the screen from the other gospel locations. And again, we're not going to go flipping all the pages. There's additional information about each of these. But we are told he's in a desolate place. He's near a mountain. And that when it's done, he's going to ascend the mountain and he's going to send the disciples in their boat across to Bethsaida. The distance from this shoreline right here, which is right on the north side of the big city of Tiberias, across the lake, if you follow the shoreline over here, if you follow the shoreline over here, it'd be kind of like in here if the picture was just wider, is where we think that city of Bethsaida was. And it's a distance of about 8 miles. It's a long run to get over to Bethsaida, no matter how you go. So they're going to be rowing off before this is over. So where does this event take place? We don't know. We really just don't. The location for what is called the Sermon on the Mount is probably this little hill over here, again on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. But this is the southern slope of Mount Arbel, which is the biggest mountain in the area right there, by far larger than any other that's right on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, and very centrally located next to the biggest city that you have on the sea or have ever had on the Sea of Galilee, period, in all of history. And then all these communities on the northern shore as well. So as we move to this location, we don't know where it took place. But I would suggest that you have this natural valley right here, which for personal reasons that you can ask Susan and Emma about, I have dubbed the Valley of Sweltering Death. I just love humiliating the tuna. Anyway, that's an adventure you got to ask them about. But we stayed this last May in a location that would be just out of view right here. So we were in a place, you know, it's right over here like this, and we did some hiking down in this valley and around the edges of Mount Arbel as well. All I'm proposing is that, you know, that would be just such a great location to gather several thousand people and then send the apostles across the lake as you walk up the gentler slopes of Mount Arbel. So it just happens to be one of several locations that would fit the bill for us very well. But regardless of whether or not that's it, let's go to Matthew chapter 14 now and look at verses 15 through 21. When it was evening, the disciples came to him saying, "The place is desolate, the time's already passed, it's getting late. So send the multitudes away that they may go into the villages and buy food for themselves." But Jesus said to them, "They don't need to go away. You give them something to eat." They said to him, "We have here only 5 loaves and 2 fishes. He said, "Bring them here to me." Ordering the multitudes to recline on the grass, he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish. Looking up toward heaven, he blessed the food, and breaking the loaves, he gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the multitudes. They all ate, were satisfied, and they picked up what was left over, the broken pieces, 12 full baskets. And there were about 5,000 men who ate, aside from the women and children. By the way, you know, so often people say, well, women occupy this second class, you know, position, and they don't even get numbered, you know, and folks like to take offense at all of that. Brother, if you've got a collection of 5,000 people, and again, some cultural overtones here as well, but you bring all these, you know, these 5,000 people, you're going to be preaching, working with them for hours, and you've got women and children there. Who's going to be the easiest to count? You're going to run around chasing the children? And for the kids' sake, who's going to be spending more time taking care of the kids? It's the women. The women and the children are going to be far more mobile, moving around and taking care of various kinds of business while we're going through all these hours. Anybody used to take any kind of offense, they had a more separated kind of a culture than we do anyway, which is fine and no sin involved. But, you know, it'd just be more difficult as well. So I don't know, maybe that's an explanation for counting only the men, but bear in mind that it'd also be harder for women and children to get there. And so we're going to count the men. It's the larger number, perhaps, and then, you know, more easily counted. They're all sitting right there and steady. You know, I can tick them off. It's 5,000 of them. However many else. What do we do? Jesus says, bring me the young boy's lunch, and I will turn it into food for 5,000, and we'll have left over huge amounts more than we originally started with. Who's impressed? Everybody is impressed. They all know what it is that they have seen. So this has its intended effect. It demonstrates that he has power over all of nature. Now, I'm passing kind of quickly over that one because we're going to come back to a very similar one in just a minute. A little later, he's going to do this with 4,000. So we'll come back to that in a minute. But look at Matthew now, the next verses, 22 through 23. So I've just mentioned it was about 8 miles across the lake right there. And in Matthew 14, starting at verse 22, immediately, he made the disciples get into the boat, go ahead of him to the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. Now, you might imagine, by this time, it's getting very late in the afternoon. Darkness may even be falling. Everybody needs to get back home. Tiberias is a huge town, but not too far away, a couple of miles, you know, walk around there and get home. And those that have to go farther, down the lake again, around the corner, onto the North Shore, let's get everybody home now. We fed them. They're going to have their energy. You know, send them home. So that the meeting breaks up. Disciples are rowing across the lake. And in 23, after he had sent the multitudes away, he went up to the mountain by himself to pray. When it was evening, he was there alone. But the boat was already many stadia, and as you can see in your margin, probably it's about 600 feet, you know, so multiply that by whatever you want, but they're, you know, a mile or more offshore. The boat was already many stadia away from the land, battered by the waves, for the wind was contrary. In the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. When the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were frightened, seeing it is a ghost, and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, take courage, it is I. Do not be afraid. Peter answered him and said, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. Kind of amazing to me, when you read Mark's account of this, Peter isn't even mentioned. So I came back to Matthew from Mark so you can see this aspect of what took place at this moment. But Jesus said, take courage, and Lord, if it's you, and come on the water. So in 29, apparently Peter took some courage, took a lot of it. I'm impressed. I don't know that I could have. And he said, come, and Peter got out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. Now, if you were to stop right there, how successful is Peter at water walking? He's doing great. He's doing just fine. He's doing it as well as the Lord did. But seeing the wind, he became afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, Lord, save me. Immediately, Jesus stretched out his hand, took hold of him, and said to him, ah, you little faith, why did you doubt? And when they got into the boat, the wind stopped, and those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, you are certainly God's son. When they crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret. So this again is a little bit hard to tell from the preceding picture. I'm not sure if their journey got interrupted and they went to Gennesaret. I don't think so. Looks like they got men of Bethsaida, looking at the other gospels, and then came back on another occasion. So we'll get to Gennesaret. But I did want to show you this particular artist illustration. I've looked and looked for years to find a decent kind of an illustration of what this may have looked like. Please note, the waves and the wind are so violent. And this happens on this lake, you know, that, you know, Peter's frightened by it. And Peter's, you know, a guy who knows these winds and the waves. And it's amazing to me. It also mentions, you know, the stilling as a part of this miracle. You look at all the artist's illustrations, and I guess maybe I've seen dozens, and they've been drawing this, you know, for hundreds of years. It's just amazing to me how the water is usually just flat as can be. And it just misses the whole point. Finally, I found this one this time around. I hadn't seen it ever before. Note how he's kind of sheltering, you know, the wind's breaking over the bow and all of that. That's much more like what it would have been like. How, you know, you walk on water is anybody's guess. Nobody's ever done it before. So I don't know if Jesus, you know, is up to his knees in the water as the waves come through, or if he's stepping on crests and all the rest of that. But I just hope that we'll get a feel, you know, for Peter, maybe feel a little bit sorry for him. You know, he shouldn't have doubted and all of that. But whatever was going on was apparently pretty violent, and it scared him as a seasoned fisherman. But what did he do? He slipped up at the end, but he got out of that boat. Wow. You got to hand it to Peter. And he got some distance, apparently, from the boat. Far enough, apparently, that he figured now that his faith was failing him and he's sinking down into the water, that he isn't going to make it back to the boat. And so he's turning to Jesus for help. Save me. Okay. By the way, please note, save me can be a term that is used with regard to salvation from sin, as it often is, or as it's used here, the same expression, salvation how? Just physically. He doesn't want to drown. He doesn't want to die. Never forget that. There are a number of places, we'll deal with them today. People make big mistakes when they're reading about people being saved, and they immediately assume that we're talking about from sin. There are contexts where that's not the case at all, and you'll miss the whole point if you think in those terms. Always allow, we could be talking about physical life, and at least plug that into your equation and consider it carefully before you just, you know, snatch the one and go off and start drawing all kinds of conclusions. So just a little bit of a warning there. But ultimately, this is one of the best known of all the miracles, so we're beginning to move faster and let it go. You know, the illustration maybe serves the purposes as well as anything. I also like this one a little bit because they did a fairly good job showing that same map or bell that we were just talking about over here, Nittai on the right, which was formed once one mountain because of an enormous earthquake before the apostles' time that split the two. So, somewhere out on that sea, in the midst of wind and waves that scared even the fishermen, here comes Jesus just strolling along. Peter, with a towering faith, brethren, learn this lesson. Not about his failure. We get that, and we share in that. But about that amazing success. You will never succeed unless you try. He succeeded for some distance. You can't come away from this just seeing the failure. When you look out at frightening circumstances and stay in the boat, there is room for criticism. Now, Jesus wishes his faith had sustained him all the way. He could have walked clear to Bethsaida if he wanted all 8 miles, but he couldn't. But he did get some distance. He'll learn his lessons, and hopefully we will too. Get out there, brethren, and do the scary stuff. Go do what you've never, ever done before. What you can't imagine ever doing. And proved it, because you've never done it before. What I'm saying is, I believe the thing to take away from this is get out of the boat. You might be surprised at how far you could go. Teaching a children's Bible class, working with a friend or a neighbor, just inviting them to come to an assembly, talking about how much it means to you in the hope that it might mean something to them. This miracle shows Jesus in absolute control over all the forces of nature. He can walk on the water, still the storm. It's impressive. So let's get out of the boat and be serious about our faith as Peter was. And then when you fail, you know, Lord save me, get back in a boat until your faith grows a little bit and get out again. Let's go to Matthew 14 now, in verses 34 through 36. When they crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret. When the men in that place recognized him, they sent into all the surrounding district, brought to him all who were sick. They began to entreat him that they might just touch the fringe of his cloak, and as many as touched it were cured. You remember the story everybody's learned from that woman, Jesus pointing him out, that even if you just touch, you know, his garment, you can be healed. So that's what's taking place. Now, here we are again. Now, this is a photograph from an airplane. You can see the spread right here. Farrell Jenkins and I were on a private flight. We chartered this plane in 2011. So it's a seven-year-old photograph. But it's one of the best I've ever seen. Farrell snapped this one. And you can see, again, Mount Arbel, the long slope, you know, it's coming down three times farther than what you see right here. So it'll be easy to walk up. Our Valley of Sheltering Death, it's way out over here, you know, on the low end. And then you come along into what is the plain of Gennesaret. Today the lake is really low. The old shoreline was probably about here, and you can just tell, you know, all this grew up because the water levels have gone down. But Magdala has been discovered now, where Mary was from. And I just wanted to point out right here, it's one of the better developed sites in all of Israel right now. It's a first century synagogue. It's just almost undeniable that Jesus would have been there. He's preaching in all the synagogues along this coast. And that is seated right here. So the water line came right up to the city right there. And then this plain, maybe in ancient antiquity, the water levels had been even higher. Because you can see it made this natural, very fertile area also very, very flat. And Jesus is working all the little communities that you can find to this day. There's some up just around this hill right here, you know, that dot the area. Matthew 14, 34 through 36 just simply says, all who were sick are healed, and this is our plain of Gennesaret. So I'm getting to the point, this miracle study, as I said, is so much more comprehensive for me than anything I've ever done before. I'm being shocked by how many miracles have taken place. I hope that you are too. I'm beginning to wonder, when Jesus got done after 3.5 years, was anybody sick in Israel? I'm beginning to think it was just the healthiest place on the planet. Jesus healed everybody. He sent the apostles out. They healed everybody. It says all. It says they just scurried as soon as they found out he was anywhere near. And they ran, and what did they do? Carried everybody in, dug holes in the flat roofs and lowered them down. You know, it was panic to get to Jesus. If I could just touch him. You know, and so the fever pitch of interest was phenomenal. We kind of get to where we sort of get jaded, I guess. We take it for granted. Jesus did a lot of miracles, you know. Brethren, this is a really small country. And so he's just healing everybody, taking care of them all, not just out of compassion, but what? He's working the signs to show that he is the Son of God, the very conclusion that the apostles just reached in the boat. Matthew 15, verses 21 through 28. Jesus went away from there, withdrew into the district of Tyre and Sidon. Behold, a Canaanite woman came out from that region and began to cry out, saying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." But he did not answer her a word. His disciples came to him, kept asking him, saying, "Send her away." She's shouting out after us. But he answered and said, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." And she came and began to bow down before him, saying, "Lord, help me." He answered and said, "It's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she said, "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs feed on the crumbs which fall from their master's table." Then Jesus answered and said to her, "O woman, your faith is great. Be it done for you as you wish." And her daughter was healed at once. Now, you all know the story from Ezekiel, and this is not the place for all the prophecies about Tyre, the place for spreading nets and bear, you know, from that point on, as Alexander the Great fulfills this prophecy. Now, this is just the tiniest little bit of that bare rock as you look then along the coast at what is modern Tyre today. This is Lebanon. I've never been in this area and wouldn't dream of doing so. You know, there it would be dangerous. And so I have no expectations to get to Lebanon anytime soon. But that this would be Tyre. It's not very far. Now, Jesus, as you know, is quite the walker, and his disciples and everybody of the time. It's really not all that far from Galilee itself, just a little ways up the coast. So Galilee would be farther down as you look south there. But when this event takes place, it is really unusual. This is the one time Jesus is working with someone who is not of the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And he's really pointed about it. That's another thing, brethren, to remember in all your Bible studies. What Jesus did would impact everyone, Jew or Gentile. But it would also put an end to the Jew-Gentile distinction. And I think really quite necessary that while he was so focused on the Jews, all the prophecies are rooted in the Jews, all the Old Testament, all of that, still he came to this region and made the point, I will not refuse the Gentiles, even, you know, years before they're going to be openly received into the kingdom. So somewhere right around in here, as you look at the Gospels, one says Tyre and Sidon, the other says Tyre. Close cities to each other, but Tyre seems to have been, of the two, the place where it was closer that it took place. Let's try to jump through one more. In chapter 15, verses 29 through 31, departing from there, Jesus went along by the Sea of Galilee, having gone up to the mountain. He was sitting there. Great multitudes came to him, bringing with them lame, crippled, blind, dumb, and many others. And they laid them down at his feet, and he healed them. How many exceptions? Because they didn't have enough faith. None. So the multitude marveled as they saw the dumb speaking, the crippled restored, the lame walking, the blind seeing. And they what? Glorified the God of Israel. So, we'll stop right there today. This, again, is Mount Arbel looking down right now at Magdala. Right underneath this shelter is where the synagogue is. From the town that Mary of Magdalene, and Mary the Magdalene of Magdala, lived. It is also where your plain of Gennesaret comes to an end as it meets the steep slopes of Mount Arbel coming down to the Sea of Galilee. So, it's about 8 miles across the Bethsaida from right here. And very close to where we stayed on the other side of this mountain here. But, brethren, who is Jesus failing to heal? Nobody that he attempts to heal. If you have his power today, you cannot fail. Doesn't matter if the people believe or not. And if that excuse is going to be used today, then fine. Show me your driver's license from Nazareth. You'd be the only one with an excuse. Okay, class dismissed.